Well, Frank Gilfeather, it's a real pleasure to have you on the Journey Home podcast.
Thank you.
You have had a long career in boxing and journalism.
Yes.
And I'm delighted to have you here. Frank, give us a little bit of background about your life growing up and how you got into boxing.
Well, I grew up in the Lochy area of Dundee. My dad ran boxing clubs from about the end of World War II right up into the 60s. So when he had the original Lochy Amateur Boxing Club. There was another one, Lochy Boys Amateur Boxing Club, which you know. And but he had the Lochy. But before that, he had a club within the Cox's Jute Mill complex in Lochy called the Camperdown Club. So anyway, the bottom line is when he had the Lochy Club, at the age of four, I started to just go with him to the club. And so I was soaking up the atmosphere. My two older brothers were boxers at a very high level. And I started to soak up the atmosphere, get involved, watch them, listen to them. All that stuff was sinking in. And then, you know, we moved to another club. And so I just carried on and then started boxing as a youth, won all the championships which were available to me. And then went on to become a senior. Actually, I was 16. In those days, seniors started at 17. Nowadays, it's 19. But I'd run out of opponents when I was 16. And so the club I was with at the time, the St. Francis Club, I was a founder member of that club 65 years ago.
A great club.
Right. And so they said to the governing body, would you allow him to me to box seniors? And they said, okay, fine. I went through a terrific year boxing all the seniors. And I don't think I lost one. In fact, I was the youngest boxer to box for Scotland while still a youth.
How many fights would you have in a year?
Well, that was the thing. You know, people can't get their head around this now because, you know, when I get kids at the gym where I do some coaching and they'll say, well, did you box? Yeah, I boxed. How many fights did you have? And they're probably thinking about 15 or 20. And I said, well, overall, about 200. Ah, sure. You know, but that's the way it was. You were boxing how many times in a year? Probably, well, if you take the championships, you box three times in the one night. If you got into the final, I always got into the final and I usually won them. Right. So if you're in a youth tournament or a senior tournament at district level, that's three times in the one night. Then the Scottish Championships, three times in the one night. And then you've got stuff in between, international events and so on. So probably I boxed about 12, 15 times a year.
It's a lot of fights.
Yeah.
And three times in one night is... I'm going to come back to that.
Yeah.
But I want to ask you, Frank, because we were talking about Dundee and your early life in boxing. What was Dundee like growing up at that time and how big was boxing in Dundee?
Dundee had always been what we call a boxing town, like Glasgow. And it goes way, way back. I mean, I knew old professional boxers who used to come up about the gym. And they would, you know, help coach, or they would just generally be there and as helpers, sweeper uppers, anything like that. Old booth fighters, the boxing booths in the fairgrounds, where guys would go and, you know, there'd be a lineup of boxers on the stage, as it were, outside the tent. And you would get the MC calling people to say, do you want a challenge? You know, what weight are you? You could fight him and so on. And they thought if they paid and they beat the professional, which they rarely did, then they would win money. And in those hard days, I mean, long before my time. So growing up, you know, Dundee was a real boxing town. I mean, there was a lovely man called Freddie Tennant who boxed, I don't know, he must have boxed 150 pro fights. He would walk, and he wasn't the only one. He would walk from Dundee to places like Forfar or Blairgowrie or wherever the fairground was so that he could fight in the booth, right, for money. Because, you know, this we're talking about the 20s and the 30s. And so I think just about every industrial city where poverty was extreme and people needed to do something extra for money. You know, mass unemployment, you know, huge poverty issues. These guys would fight to earn money. And so boxing was seen, and boxing had the Caird Hall, you know, 3,000 people there, big professional tournaments, loads of amateur clubs, boxing, you know, different parts of the Midlands District, Angus and Perthshire and so on. So it was kind of inbred in you in Dundee that the two big things in Scotland in those days were football and boxing. And boxing was just about on a par with football in terms of its popularity. People went to see boxing in huge numbers, and they knew all about boxing. They knew about the people who are making the news in boxing circles, and they were kind of enraptured by it. And it was a great time for boxing, and you know, huge events. I mean, I boxed twice in the Royal Albert Hall against England, 7,000 people there each time.
In the amateurs?
Yeah, in the amateurs.
You just wouldn't get that now.
No, you wouldn't. And now the amateurs, you know, they're boxing the Scottish Championships in
Ravenscraig.
A giant shed almost in Ravenscraig, you know. It's a warehouse.
I've been there.
I haven't been out, but I've seen it.
It was purpose-built for the Commonwealth Games, wasn't it? But it's not like the Royal Albert Hall.
But I mean, you know, the atmosphere. Can you imagine? The whole place is darkened except for the canopy lights over the ring.
It's very professional, that.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, all the Scotland internationals and the major Scotland and England events were televised live by the BBC every Thursday.
And they should go back to that. That would be fantastic if they would televise amateur events.
Well, it would, but you see, there isn't interest now. And if you'll know that because you're involved, and you'll know when you go to events, it's really just about the mums and dads and their, you know, and the grannies and grandads. But then if you went to the Caird Hall, my dad brought the American team over. About, it would have been the late 1950s, 3,000 people. Can't get tickets for weeks and weeks before the event. Sold out.
Late 1950s?
Yeah, yeah.
There must have been a lot of interest in Dundee at that time.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, of course, you had Dick McTaggart from Dundee, yeah. Olympic champion. And you had so many people boxing in Scotland who were household names. And that, you know, why was that? Because when we went abroad, for example, to box for Scotland, the Daily Express, which was the biggest newspaper in the day, 650,000 sales every day, the Daily Record and the Daily Mail would send boxing correspondents with us so that everything was recorded. You know, the preamble, the boxing, and then the post-fight stuff, you know, it was all in the papers. All in the back page, splashed all over the shop. So it was a great time.
What's your first memory, Frank, of a fight? I mean, is there a fight that you really remember that sticks in your mind the first time that you could recall that was a hard fight? Or
well, I've recorded lots of, I recalled lots of hard fights. I mean, my first one, it was a kind of what you might call in Dundee as a kiddie on fight. It was my dad's ran a little show, and I was 7, and there was another kid from another club, same age, roughly the same size, and so on. So they put us on at the start of the evening as a kind of warm up, you know, give the crowd a laugh and all that. It was no decision; it was just a bit fun. I remember that well, but going through. I mean, I had lots of difficult fights. When you reach a certain level, they're all difficult. You know, growing up, 15, 16, I breezed through it. 17, yeah, it was terrific, you know. But then the more victories you have, then you step up a level. And then at 18 and so on, you're boxing for Scotland. But we were boxing a lot against the Eastern European countries. And they're virtually full-time, you know. Because they had no professional boxing, so there was no kind of pathway for their amateur boxers if they wanted to turn professional because they didn't have pro boxing. So the result was at 18, 17, 18, 19, you were facing guys who were 26, 27. They were men. We were just kids. I remember, I'll tell you a story about being in Bulgaria. And what you used to do is you used to line up one team on one side of the ring and the other team on the other side of the ring. And the MC would introduce flyweight for Scotland is so-and-so, flyweight for Bulgaria is so-and-so. You would walk in, shake hands in the center of the ring. Then you would go to the opposite side. So the Scots guy would join the Bulgarians and so on. And as they went up the line, of course, the teams had changed sides with the intros. And I'm looking at this guy across the ring from me before the, and I thought, nah, it's not for me. He's too big. He's too athletic. He's a man, you know. And I'm looking up the line of our guys. And I'm looking at guys like Andy Peace, who was a welterweight from Fife. He was a minor. Tom Imrie, ABA champion from Edinburgh. I said, I think I've got your guy, you know, I don't think he's mine. And the guy heard me and said, are you Gil Feather? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, I'm Pilichev. I'm boxing you. And I thought, in the name of God.
Is he big, like?
He beat me on points.
Okay.
And he, but it turned out, see, these are the innocent days. He, no video, nobody knew anybody. He was the European silver medalist. Now, the Europeans, as Dick McTaggart would tell you, even today, well, I read an interview he did for a website the other day. The Europeans were more difficult to win than the Olympics because the Europeans, the standard, mainly because of the European, the Eastern European countries, the standard was so much higher.
Concentrated in Europe.
Right. So it was harder to win. So I bought, and that was fine. So what you did when you went abroad to box for Scotland, you boxed twice, Thursday and Saturday. That's what I mean when I was saying earlier how the number of fights, developed in terms of your overall figure. So that every time you went abroad, you boxed twice. I was boxing the next time in a city called Plovdiv, which was the second city of Bulgaria. And there were only two winners that night for Scotland, me and Kenny Buchanan. Ken was the featherweight coming out of the ring after winning, and I was next in, and he said, good luck, and I said, well done. And he said, yeah, but look at that. And he showed me his neck, and he showed me the bite marks on his neck. And I said, the name of goodness, what? He said, yeah, the guy was biting me in the clinches.
Did you wear a gum shield at this
time?
Yeah,
but what you saw was the impression of the lower molars, not the top one. So you just saw, because the guy was biting, and of course, Bulgarian referee, he was just kind of waved it away. But Buchanan won, I went in and I won, and we were the only two guys to win on that entire trip. They were so difficult, the Eastern Europeans.
Well, you'd expect Ken Buchanan to win, and well done, Frank, for you winning as well.
Yeah, well, Buchanan was an extraordinary fighter, of course, went on to become an world champion. I boxed him in the Leithtown Hall. There you are, it was a sellout, 1,200 people. Fantastic atmosphere.
You boxed Ken Buchanan.
Yeah, but well, he and I were, before that, we were featherweights. And he and I, we vied for the featherweight vest, if you like, for Scotland. And so we said, we have to fight. Oh, goodness. Right, I was beginning to get heavier. Right, he was trim and fine, tall for a featherweight, 9 stone. And they said, okay, if you want a box, we'll have this match, but we'll make the match at 9 stone 2, right? But I was more comfortable at 9'4", 9'5". I was beginning to edge towards lightweight. And we said, okay. I went in. It was badly handled. I went in at 8'13". And Kenny was 9'2". That was fine. He beat me well. It was a great fight. I remember it well. It was a great fight. It was a thriller for the crowd. After that, I moved up to lightweight because I was going to make that comfortably. Then he and I became teammates and roommates for Scotland. When we went abroad, we shared a room, and he was the featherweight, I was the lightweight. So, and poor Kenny died just a year ago, a year and 2 weeks ago, he died. And he was a great, great fighter.
I did meet him a couple of times. Yeah. He'd come to Arbroath, really nice guy. And I think it's sad when you think of Kenby Cannon that he didn't get really the recognition he deserved. If you were the undisputed lightweight champion of the world now, the recognition you would get would be incredible. But
But just think about it. Josh Taylor, does he get the recognition?
Not right now, no.
No, he doesn't. Why is that?
I don't know.
He's from Edinburgh.
You think that's what it is?
Yeah. I said that to Buchanan. I said, if you'd been from Glasgow, Jim Watt was fated.
Aye.
You know, it was a Glaswegian.
And Ricky Burns.
And Ricky Burns. Scott Harrison. Because Glasgow is a boxing city. Edinburgh couldn't care less. I mean, even after Josh Taylor, undisputed champion, and he's talking about, I'd like my next world title fight to be either at Edinburgh Castle or at Easter Road. And I said, that's never going to happen because no promoter would take the chance to put even a world champion from Edinburgh on in Edinburgh because he would lose money. People aren't interested in Edinburgh.
I've been down to see him a couple of times at the Hydro, and I think he is a fantastic fighter. Just an incredible specimen. And you know what I love about Josh Taylor? When he is fighting, he can go into the trenches.
Yes.
If he chooses.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and that's exciting. It's really exciting because he's a talented fighter and he can fight.
Well, that's the balance that you want. You want to be able to box a fighter and fight a boxer. Sugar Ray Robinson used to say that. That's what you need to do. If you're a beautiful boxer and your opponent's a fighter, you box him. If it's the other way around, you've got to be able to fight him. So, you know, there's not a lot of people have that in their makeup in boxing, but you get the special ones. Taylor's like that, yeah.
Aye. So what do you think Josh Taylor should do with his career then? Should he be looking to move to the States or something like that? Or
I think it's too late for him now. I think he's got a fight coming up.
Jack Catterall.
Yeah. And I think when he fought Catterall before, of course, it was very controversial because most people thought Catterall had won. And probably deep down, although he wouldn't admit it, Josh probably thought, that Catterall did enough to win. Now, isn't it strange that despite the fact that Josh Taylor was an undisputed champion of the world, nobody wanted to actually go and make a big fuss of it? You know, he wasn't fated. He wasn't the promoters weren't clamouring for his signature for a fight. Only now are they doing so because the Catterall decision was so controversial. Now they want a rematch, and that's going to it's going to create interest. And I think the fight's going to be in Leeds.
It's a good fight, Frank. It's not the biggest fight in the world.
No.
You know, like I would love to see him in the ring with Terence Crawford. You know. Somebody really big. And whether he could win that or not, but that's the big money fights.
Yeah,
that's the real
that's
big
right,
time.
But there's
no
appetite. I mean, really and truthfully, if you speak to a bunch of people who were even slightly interested in boxing and mentioned Terence Crawford, then, oh yeah, I've heard of Terence. If you said Josh Taylor, he's not a big name. He's not a household name. Even in Scotland. And so, you know, despite the fact he's immensely talented, undisputed world champion, nobody's heard of him.
Why is that?
Well, is he colourful? Is he a guy who would excite the TV audiences? I think that's what, you know, if you could get a TV audience, you know, dying to pay money to see you, if you get guys filling auditoria all over the place to see you, then that's an exciting fighter. But if there's no great... And the other thing is this. Where's the publicity for boxing now? Not, you know, newspapers are not interested anymore.
And I think you'll agree with me on this. The boxing that's getting the press is nonsense. It's yeah. YouTube boxing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Well, there you are. You've hit the nail on the yeah. head there, right? You've got Jake Paul going to fight Mike Tyson.
Sorry, Frank. Yeah. It's just so, when you say it, it's just so ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, and I did a video about this, right, giving my views on it, and I was bombarded with comments agreeing. Other people were saying, oh, well, Jake Paul, you know, he's come on as a fighter. I'm saying, hang on a second. He's actually only boxed one boxer in a contest, Tommy Fury, who's kind of mediocre, and he got beat. Now, but he's been boxing all these guys in so-called yeah. exhibitions. So it's a spar.
His next move from Tommy Fury's Mike Tyson.
Yeah,
it's quite the step up.
But Tyson's going to be, this is going to be, the fascinating thing for me is Tyson's going to be 58 mm-hmm. when he fights him. If he's been training, as we are led to believe, and we see the Instagram stuff and the TikTok stuff, and you think, wow, if he hits Jake Paul, he's going to knock him into kingdom come. But I think there'll be an agreement that, right, you know, it's a spar. Let's treat it as a spar and let's get through it. The other question about it is, will Tyson be able to do that? Or will he, you know, think, no, I've got to go for real?
My worry is how badly does Mike Tyson need money? That's my worry, because I think what's in the contract? If he wins or if he loses, does he get paid a lot more if he loses? Is that in the contract? No, I don't know how these things work.
You know, but there's another thing here. And that is, in many ways, the integrity, what's left of the integrity of professional boxing, is at stake here. Can you imagine if Jake Paul... Well, there's no decision. Remember, it's an exhibition. A spar. Imagine if Jake Paul were to outbox Tyson and leave him looking like a fool. What does that do for the integrity of boxing? A YouTuber, you know, it's like me going and saying to John McEnroe, let's go to Westbourne Park and we'll have a game of tennis.
It's like a taxi driver thinking he can race Lewis Hamilton around a yes. track, you know?
Well, there you are, that's a decent analogy. You know, and you've got Jake Paul. I mean, let's face it, there's Netflix are going to, you know, because people are so interested in it. But the boxing fraternity, no, it's just a caper, really.
You know, this is the one thing, although he really bugs me, Jake Paul. I admire the fact that there's a man who's managed to carve out a place for himself and make a lot of money, whereas a lot of pro boxers haven't been able to do that.
Oh, yeah.
They can't promote themselves the way that he is.
No.
A bit like Naz, you know, he just promote himself.
Yeah.
But Michael,
if you're a promoter, right, and you're looking at this guy's social media footprint, and this guy wants to box and he trains like a boxer, give him his due. You're going to say, how do we capitalize on his zillions of followers on YouTube and whatever channel he's on? Oh, right, let's match him with, you know, let's do pay-per-view or whatever. So the promoters are calling the shots in boxing these days, not the governing bodies. They're just a waste of space. They're a waste of time. The WBA and all these guys, not that they've sanctioned this one, but I'm talking about generally. The big one, of course, was Tyson Fury and Ngannou. Right?
Was that sanctioned by a governing body?
Yeah, that was sanctioned. Not only that, the guy who wasn't a boxer, still isn't a boxer, he's beaten in his fight against Fury, and then he's given a WBA ranking of number 10 in the world. And his next fight's against Joshua, and Joshua did what he had to do, and that's what Tyson Fury couldn't do and should have done.
To me, I mean, Francis Ngannou's got a big neck, and it just shows... If he didn't have a neck like that, that would be a really dangerous position for anybody to be in, because he took a full force shot. It was like a guy hitting a punching machine on holiday. You know, it was full... Joshua had no fear of getting hit at all. He loaded up with that and he hit the guy square in the face. One of these guys is going to end up getting hurt stepping in like that.
Yeah, I agree. And that's the danger. These guys who are convinced by the promoters, Ryan, he's a top UFC fighter who as a kid trained as a boxer, right? So he'll know how to stand, he'll know how to punch and so on. He didn't. He was a big, fearsome-looking guy. I think from Fury's point of view, he didn't prepare properly for that.
No, he looked like, to me, he looked like a guy who was just getting by on knowledge.
Yeah, yeah.
He looked like a guy that thought, I don't need to bother.
No, you know? You're right.
I can use what I know. And folk were criticising him afterwards. You're like, you can see he didn't train for that.
So that's the corruption side of boxing. That's about squeezing money out of people by pretending that this is a real fight.
Aye.
And they bought it into it.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, when you look back at the early part of Amir Khan's career, the public seemed to turn against him. And I thought Frank Warren was to blame because they kept lining up duds for him, you know, lining up all these useless journeymen to fight Amir Khan. And the public were getting frustrated with this. And it's a bit like what they're doing with Jake Paul. They're like, just keep feeding him dummies.
Yeah.
And keep the gravy train going. Keep the money coming in.
Keep it going, yeah. And it's the same with Frank Bruno. You know, Frank Bruno. And yeah, this is what happens still. If you've got a bright prospect and you're a good manager and you're a promoter of this guy, you will make sure that his first, I don't know, 10, 12 contests are against so-called journeymen, guys who can't possibly hurt him, won't damage him, won't beat him, but will give their fighter experience and rounds that he needs. And then you raise the bar a bit as you go on. I think there's lots of things wrong with boxing, professionally and in the amateurs as well.
Okay, let me stay on that subject a little bit. And as a coach, I want to ask you your opinion. If Jake Paul walked into your gym, what would be the route that you give him to learn as a boxer and to compete in boxing?
Right, well, that's an interesting point because, and I was discussing this with somebody only today who used to box here in Aberdeen as a kid, an amateur right up until he was probably about 18 or 19. And what I found was, and he actually hit the nail on the head today when he said, oh, I remember I went to the boxing club. I won't tell you which one. I went to the boxing club, he said, and you went in and somebody said, yeah, you go and skip, you know, you learn how to skip and some shadow boxing, get on the bike. He said, but nobody actually taught me how to box. So, and I said, I found that's even prevalent today. So many moons ago, a few years back, I went back to the gym to start training when I was maybe in my 60s, maybe my mid-50s. I was keeping fit and then work commitments would take me out of the loop for two, three, 4 weeks and then it's hard to get back into it. You get lazy and you think, oh, I'll go next week. I'll go next week. But when I started, I was training three times a week. I was fit and I was happy to get my, I was doing 50 minutes to an hour every time. And then I noticed in the club where I was, nobody's actually taking kids aside and saying, this is how you do it. They were just shouting, time, and these guys go back. And somebody would go around the bag and go for 5 seconds. No, no, go bang, 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 bang. All right, okay, and walk to the next guy. I think, hang on, nobody's actually taking these kids aside and saying, this is how you do it, and here's the reason why you do it. I always think you've got to give the why. Why are we doing this? Well, we're doing it because of this. And so I started doing that. The wee ones, you can forget about them because they're only in it for the fun, you know. But when you get to 14, 15, 16, you want them to take it a bit more seriously and you want them to listen. And so that was what was happening. And meanwhile, the guys who ran the boxing club were looking after their kind of their elite boxers, if you like. Their three or four guys who were seniors or top youth boxers. And they were only interested in them. But there was all these kids going around. Nobody's teaching them. So I started doing it myself. My son Paul, he would come along too, and he'd boxed when he was a youth, Northeast Championships and so on, and he was teaching as well, and he was helping. And people were generally speaking being ignored, and so we took that on, and then the club began to kind of recognise us and said to me, you need to become a coach. I thought, all right, okay, fine. We'll get you registered as a coach. And I said, yeah, okay, fine. And they got the forms, fill in the forms. You get a written test, like box ticking. And I thought, oh, here we go. I don't need this. And then they said, then you'll have to go to a two-hour seminar. You'll become a registered coach, and then you'll do another 2 hour seminar, and that gets you into grade two or whatever. I'd kind of switched off by that. And I said, hang on, I've been doing, you know, I know more about boxing than you will ever. And you want some guy who is basically what us boxers call PE teachers, you know, some guy who's got a bit of paper to say, look, I'm a registered coach. I'm now going to conduct this seminar to tell you how to coach. I said, I don't think so. So I never went down that route. And the social media thing started because I was in with Gregor McPherson, a young professional from Aberdeen, as you know, training in his gym, his dad's gym. And I was pointing out one or two things. Very receptive is Gregor. You know, he's keen to learn. He's keen to build on his skills and technique. And my son filmed a couple of these things, and he said, I'm going to put these on TikTok. And I'd heard of TikTok, but I didn't have the app or anything. And it went on TikTok. TikTok went, wow, just went overnight. It just exploded. I thought, and he was saying, you'll never guess.
What was the reel? What was the video that really exploded
well,
it?
The video that sold it was, here you are. This is a new thing to me. A wall-mounted, but... wall-mounted punch bag.
Uh-huh. I've seen them. It's like an angle thing.
Yeah. Well, So I said, this would be good to show the uppercut. So I start to show the uppercut and take your chin off the line in case, for, you know, you get a counter-attack and thumped on the chin. And I'm a great believer in protecting your chin at all times. And not enough attention is paid to the defensive aspect of boxing, in my view. Did this, the right uppercut, take your chin, the left uppercut, you do it this way. That just went crazy. And then, you know, do some more. Yeah, we're on the punch bag. Went in the ring with Gregor, and I said, I'll show you how to parry. I'll show you how to block. Instead of taking left jabs in the face, I'll show you how to prevent that. I'll show you how to do this. And so it went on. And before I knew where I was, it was 50,000 followers. And now TikTok's at about, I think it's 270,000.
And Instagram, I checked today, 400,000 followers
on
Instagram.
We just turned to 400.
Unbelievable.
I know. Well, the Instagram thing was interesting because nothing was happening there. We were posting and nothing was happening. And I'm no big deal. I'm. This was a bit fun for me. I wasn't really invested in it. And then one day, an Instagram page, which concerns itself only with the boxing, used one of my videos, and somebody, alerted me to this. And I went on. We looked at it, and it was one of my videos, and all their other stuff were still pictures of famous fights and famous fighters. Mine was the only video. We got in touch with the people and said, yeah, thanks very much for using it. I'm glad you've credited me with this. And they said, oh, yeah, could we use some more? I said, yeah. You know, within about 2 weeks, they'd used 16 videos. And then I went to say, hang on a second. These are mine.
Basically, it's your channel.
Yeah, and I'm going round the gyms in Glasgow, Hamilton, Arbroath. I went to Dundee. I went up to Elgin. And you guys are pinching my stuff. So I said, enough's enough, you know. Mm-hmm. And so what happened was, but the good thing from that was while their following doubled virtually overnight because of my videos – my Instagram took off.
Right.
And now in 4 months, I've gone from 170, not 170,000, 170 to 400,000 on Instagram. And that sparked a lot of other stuff. I do seminars all over the country. I'm invited everywhere to do seminars.
That's great.
I've got a guy coming up from London next month for a 2-hour session with me.
Have you thought about doing like an online boxing course? Like making some kind of like online?
Yeah. I've had so many comments over the piece saying, why are you giving all this skill, expertise, technique away for nothing? I never thought about anything else. And we'd considered, well, let's do a YouTube channel where I take through. And then out of the blue, we had a call from a guy in Boston from an organization called dynamicstriking.com, who are the biggest combat sport download channel in the world. They've got Mike Tyson, they've got Anderson Silva, they've got the guys, all the MMA and UFC guys, the top guys. They said, can we send a crew over for a couple of days to for you to do some tutorials, 3-4 minute videos, how to do this, how to do that, how to throw this punch, how to throw. And I said, yeah, fine. So we did it, and it's due, I think, next week or the week after. So these tutorials, they will charge people $100 or whatever to download a series of 12 videos or thereabouts.
So you'll start to earn a commission on what you're sharing then? Is that the way it works with them?
Yeah, it's more than a commission.
Oh, nice. Okay, that's good.
And it's brilliant. And I enjoyed it. And they're good fun to do. You know, I enjoy trying to impart. And this is the big thing I thought about, Michael, that you know, it's not easy for people to coach or to teach. I don't call myself a coach. I call myself a teacher. Right. Now, where I score is because of my broadcasting past. And I'm able to articulate what I want, you know, what I want them to do, a young boxer. This is how I want you to do it. This is why we're doing it. And it sinks in, right? And a lot of guys can't do that. So I think I'm helped by that. I mean, I spent a few weeks ago, I was in Lanzarote for a week with a boxing boot camp from Glasgow. They have this boot camp where they sell packages to 20, 25 boxers, boys and girls. And they said to me, would you come and do a tutorial every day?
That's the life.
It's brilliant.
That's great.
And then I did. I came back for 2 days and then I went to Jersey for 4 days to do the same stuff with another lot. Jersey Boxing Academy said, you come and do a seminar? I said, well, yeah, sure, but one seminar. And they said, well, we'll fix up two more. So I did, in 2 days, I did 3 seminars. And then I had a day at each end to relax. So it's a build-up.
I can imagine.
It's crazy.
There must be professional fighters that are looking at your content that are like, would like to work with you as well.
I get that all the time.
Do you?
Yeah. I get young pros. And the funny thing is, the Americans, I mean, we sell these boxing mitts called the Noble Art. That's my brand, the Noble Art boxing mitts. Now, I have an issue, and I won't bore you with the detail, but everybody uses sparring gloves on the bag these days, right? And the sparring gloves, or competition gloves, if you want to call them that, look fantastic. But they're totally useless because you put your hand into it and the thumb of the glove is attached by a little piece of elastic.
Your thumb's pointing forward.
Yeah. So your thumb's pointing forward and you can't close your hand tightly. As a result, you can't wrap the thumb round into a fist, right? So I thought, okay, well, at least on the bag, we should have proper... I went back to my old mitts that I used 40, 50 years ago. Still had them. And of course, you can wrap, because there is no padding on the thumb, you could wrap your hand right round. And that's for punching the bag, obviously not for sparring. So I thought, what if we made these better by increasing the padding on the outside, if you like, on the knuckle part of the glove, 8 ounces, 10 ounces for the bigger hands, but kept the old bag mitt thumb so you could wrap it round into a fist, you know? And we did that. And we can't keep up with the demand.
Oh, wow. Well,
there's, I think, over 60% of our customers.
Where do you sell them?
America.
No, but is there a website? Could you find them on Amazon? Or
no, you can't.
At the moment, just on the website?
At the moment, it's www.thatnobleart.shop.
Right.
And that's where you get them. And we're actually just building a new website right now.
I'll leave a link to that for anyone that's watching in the description of this
great
video.
So that's we brought them out, and that's created an additional interest. And how to punch properly, because you can't punch properly with these sparring gloves on the bag. So these are only for the bag to teach young people, all boxers, how to punch properly. And my latest video that was sent for me yesterday was from Frank Stallone.
I saw that.
Yeah.
What's the connection there?
Well, he started following me.
This is Sly Stallone's brother.
Yeah. And Frank's been in a lot of the movies, and he's a musician.
Yeah, a country musician, wasn't he?
Yeah, singer-songwriter. And he started following me and started commenting on some of my videos. And so I did a couple of podcasts, right? And it was half-hearted, nothing like as good as this stuff here. But I thought, I want to speak to these guys. Tony Parsons, the best-selling author, right? He follows me. So I said, I want to speak to Tony Parsons. He goes to the gym in London, in Hampstead. He was one of the first to buy my gloves. And Frank Stallone said, I love the look of these gloves. I said, okay, I'll send you a pair. So he got them the other day.
Amazing.
And he put a video up.
Did he do that off his own back? That's amazing.
Absolutely. And we've got guys like Gary Oldman, Dominic Cooper, the Mamma Mia actor, great actor. Guy called Dominic Purcell, who was in Prison Break. Anderson Silva, who's a top UFC fighter. All these guys are following. Ali McCoy's following you today.
He's following.
So I'm getting on, and it's brilliant, you know, but apart from that, this is a great kind of satisfying thing for me. You should see the comments I get. 99% complimentary, encouraging, saying, wow, I get, presumably they're kids, young guys, who are saying, I take my phone to the gym and I position it beside where I am so I can watch what you're doing, how to throw a jab, how to throw a left hook, etc.
It's so valuable that, because when I was boxing, the internet YouTube didn't exist. Yeah. I used to go and get videos of like Muhammad Ali, old fighters, and I'd watch them in slow motion.
Yeah.
But there was nobody like you who was breaking it down into little bits and explaining it, you know. And so that was the only way I could learn is to sit and just analyze.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing, Michael, is this. Defense, right? I've watched coaches, and I'm thinking, when are you going to teach the guy how to stop being hit? There is no point. I say to these kids, there is no point in you going into a fight, finishing up as the winner because you've hit the guy 31 times, but you're the winner, but he's hit you 30 times. Are you the winner? You know, okay, you've hit him one more time, you deserve the verdict. But have you won if you're taking 30 punches? No. So you've got to instill the ability to defend. There is no point in going into boxing if you can't defend yourself.
Frank, I knew when I started seeing your videos that you had a great defense. I knew that you had a great defense because you're in your late 70s. You had, 200 fights?
Yeah.
Over 200 fights. You're very articulate. Your face isn't mashed up, you know? And how many guys have you met in boxing? They sound like they're drunk, you know, and they're young. I mean, I've seen a couple. I met a guy, I'm not going to name names, but I met a guy who was doing the white collar boxing.
Oh,
he had about 20 fights.
Sure.
Young guy. you would think he was drunk. He was taking a pounding. And yeah, like you say, if you don't win, or say even if you do win, but you come out of the ring in that condition.
What is the point?
Yeah.
And you know something? Poor Ken Buchanan. A couple of years ago, I think there was an exhibition of boxing memorabilia at Stirling University that a guy had curated, a boxing fan. And he phoned me up. He said, "Have you got any stuff I could use?" And I've got one trophy, right? I gave away everything. People, you know, helpers, trainers, all that stuff. I said, "I've got some programs and photographs." And so I gave him some stuff. And I went down to the exhibition. First guy I bumped me was Dick McTaggart and fellow Dundonian. Dick and I were in the Scottish team together, but Dick's coming up for 88. And so he's much, much, he's 10 years older than me. But he boxed my two brothers growing up there in that kind of age group. And so we had a brief chat, and this hand, he was seated. There was a row of seats. Everybody else was standing. And this hand came up through the middle of everybody, put it towards me. And I shook it and looked, and it was Ken Buchanan. And I said, "Kenny," we all knew him as Kenny. I said, "I didn't know you were coming. That's great. I'm looking forward. We'll have a chat," because at that very moment, the exhibition was about to be pronounced open. And I said, "Oh, we'll have a chat later on." I turned away from him to look at the principal of the university who was declaring it open. And I had a tap on my shoulder, and it was a guy who'd been seated next to Buchanan. And he said to me, "What's your name?" And I told him, and I heard him. He turned around and he said to Ken, "It's Frank Gilfeather." And Ken just looked vacant. Right. So the next, you know, a wee while later, we got together. And I took him over to the part of the exhibition where my stuff was. And one of the things was a programme from the Royal Albert Hall, England against Scotland, 1964, or thereabouts. And I said, "Remember that night? What night that was?" And he looked at me and he said, "No, can't remember." And I said, "Well, remember when we went to Bulgaria and boxed in Bulgaria, and the Bulgarian team were banging on the bedroom door because they wanted to buy our shirts and wanted to buy our underwear because they didn't get any good stuff over there." And he went, "No, I can't remember that, you know." And then, you know, he died a year ago. And but poor Ken was gone. Now, what we know today are words like dementia and Alzheimer's. What we didn't know all those years ago with these same guys, we just called them punchy. Well, they're punchy. They slurred their speech, they shuffled along or whatever. And well, these were guys that were boxing in the booth, you know, every night. These were guys who were boxing in small halls.
And the intensity, I mean, I could imagine with Ken Buchanan, the people he'd been in with, like Roberto Duran and Ismael Laguna, the intensity of those fights as well. I mean, I know he was a tremendous fighter, you're taking some leather with those guys.
Yeah. Well, you're right. And of course, you're young, you're fit, you're able, and it's fine. But when you get older, that's when it starts to tell. That's when the payback is for me. You know, I stuck to the amateurs. I declined the offers to turn professional. I was at a dinner one night to mark the winning of the world flyweight title by Walter McGowan. I was Walter's chief sparring partner from the age of 15. Walter's dad, stroke manager, was a guy called Joe Gans. That's another story why he was called Joe Gans. And my trainer has said to him, "Why are you having..." Because I would go down for a week, stay with McGowan, or go down weekends, train. I train with the pros down there. Great, brilliant gym, you know. And Gans said, because he's the only one that can make Walter think. And I say, that's because I was the fastest lightweight over 100 yards going backwards. Nobody could catch me. But my dad always instilled in me, remember, you've got to protect yourself. Be good, be clever, be smart. Don't get dragged into a fight unless you have to. And he always used to say, if it's fairly even, then you've got to have a bash. That was his saying. Have a bash, and that will maybe get you over the line. And so it was, you know, it's a different era now. The amateurs are kind of like fencers. They hardly touch each other, you know?
Do you think that's a hangover from the time where you had to connect with the white part of the glove?
Yes. I watch even, going back to this stuff about the sparring gloves or the competition gloves, I even watch champion boxers now who are throwing hooks and landing with the inside of the glove. And I say to kids now, and they've all got their sparring gloves. I do seminars, and I'll say, hands up those of you who can't close your hands tightly inside the glove. And they all put their hands up. And I say, hands up those of you who are connecting with the bottom knuckles of your finger. And they all put their hands up. And you say, do you realise that that's where you're supposed to punch, with the knuckle part, flat bit here? And they go, yeah, but how do you do that? So boxing's changed.
They've sort of kind of, they have changed the rules in the amateurs a little to make it a little bit more like the pros. But I think the way they're, I don't know, the way they seem to be teaching it is it's still a head punching game.
Yeah.
There's not, you know, fighting in close isn't the way to teach an amateur. It's more visible to lift someone's head up with a punch for the five judges around the ring.
Yeah.
And for a while,
lots of judges just didn't recognise body punches. They wouldn't score them.
Aye.
They all thought that all these kids have got to be headhunters. But you know, I try to show them there are other ways to box.
A body punch can be the most sickening thing.
Tell me about it.
Worse than a head punch. Yeah. You know, a heavy shot to the head and a heavy shot to the body.
Yeah.
Can take a heavy shot to the body, just takes the wind right out of you.
Oh yeah, it's hard to recover. I boxed against France, I was 17. And the French team came to box. We used to box in a place called the Kelvin Sports Arena, which had been a former cinema, held about 800 people, 1,000 people, and it converted into an arena. And the BBC would record all the our boxing internationals there. And I was 17 and I boxed this guy called Jean Cotto. And he had, in an earlier part of his career, stopped Dick McTaggart in the European Championships. Right, I'm boxing him. And I, for two rounds, I boxed his head off. I was 17 and I was on fire that night. Everything clicked. And then in the third round, the referee was on my left-hand side. This guy took his opportunity and he threw a long left into my kidneys on the blind side of the referee. And I thought I was going to die. Oh. And I just couldn't recover. I was gasping for breath. It was awful.
Did you just collapse?
Yeah, it was awful. I got up and then the referee after a minute or so after that said, I think you've had enough. And I said, can't breathe, you know.
It's horrendous, isn't it?
It's terrible. Yeah.
Do you ever remember, was it Ricky Hatton when he fought Jose Luis Castillo?
Yeah.
And Castillo took the body shot and he just turned. He turned and immediately went to the floor and you knew.
Oh.
There's no getting up from
Finito.
That.
I know.
Speaking of, we were talking about Josh Taylor. He's a great body puncher as well. He can deliver a body punch.
Yeah. Well, you get that with the pros, don't you? But you're right with the amateurs. It's all about fencing with the amateurs. I call it fencing with boxing gloves on. Actually, if you watch an amateur fight that's not at the high level, you will see that most of the time they're throwing punches and they're about landing about a foot off the target. They're not going near the guy. They're kind of on their way back before they land the punch. And that's got a lot to do with apprehension and fear, you know, and they're thinking, well, if I get in too close, I'm going to get caught. But you've got to get over that hurdle. And so part of the thing I do is to help them, you know. And it's amazing, you know, I do a simple thing like how to block the left jab, how to block it. And what you get is lots of guys now, they want to fight like this, right? And I say to them, if I was boxing you, I would rub my hands and say, there is a God. Because you're standing like this, you are going to take my jab right through the middle. How do you, I say to them, how would you stop me? And they don't know. And I say, well, I'll tell you how. And I show them how. You put your hand in front of your chin, not on your face. They all want to do this stuff. On hand in front of the chin, and let the punch come right up to you, and it'll block. And they do it. I do it a dozen times, throw jabs at them, good jabs, hard. And they stop it, and they think, oh, light bulb moment.
Hi, so Frank, you're training in the Bod Box gym with Gregor McPherson. Gregor McPherson's there as well. Are you involved in his coaching team? Are you going to be a pro coach?
No, I'm not going to be a pro coach. I've never been a coach. I've never been a kind of registered coach of any kind. I remember about when I first came to Aberdeen from Dundee, and I was working as a news reporter on the Press and Journal, and some of the clubs in the Northeast, knowing I was there, would ask me to be the MC at their show, because I used to do it in Dundee after I stopped boxing. I remember one guy had said to me, why aren't you coaching? And I said, because nobody's asked me. And he went, all right, okay. I said, you can't just walk into a boxing club, which has been on the go for years, and say to the guys who are running it, hi, I want to be a coach here. And they say, well, how dare you? You know, I said, so you've got to be invited. And eventually, you know, up that club I was telling you about earlier, where I should do a bit of coaching, I was training there for years before they actually twigged, we can get you involved in the coaching. I was doing it anyway without being asked, because people were being left unattended, if you like. So with Gregor, his dad, Tom, I'd said to Tom, you know, there are some things I would like to say to Gregor about his style, about punch, so on, whatever it was. And his dad said, listen, you're experienced. Any help we could get from you would be, you know, would be very welcome. So only a few times, but there, last weekend, last Sunday, I go on it Sunday at 10 till 12. It's a training session. There's lots of sparring and so on. I've pulled Gregor out and say, listen, here's a way you should do it. Rather than doing this, and he's very kind of alert to learning, and he's a listener. And that's a good thing. He's not one of these guys that thinks, oh, who are you? I know it all. I'm a professional boxer. What he does do is he takes the good stuff and he'll listen. And I'm not there to make him fit, because there's not a fitter boxer, not a fitter athlete anywhere in the country than Gregor. He trains three times a day.
You know, I heard a fact about Gregor from his granddad.
Yeah.
By chance, I bumped into his granddad, right? And he told me something, and you can confirm this. And I wish I asked Gregor this on the podcast when he was on. But he said that Gregor's never drunk anything but water.
Yeah.
He's never drunk a can of juice. He's never drank Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
I just find that astonishing.
Well, I don't, when you look at him.
Oh, what a condition he's in.
Yeah, he's fantastic. You know, there's an argument, if you like, that the danger is that you become stale psychologically, and it becomes a chore. You know, then you're thinking, oh my goodness, I've got to go to the gym again today. Now, Gregor's running his dad's gym, doing one-on-ones every day. He's, you know, he's doing classes and all that kind of stuff. So he psychologically, he's in that gym, you know, every single day of the week. And psychologically, that might begin to get to him, you know. He was away on holiday in Thailand for a couple of weeks. And what was he doing? He was training every day. So
that seems to be like, he's one of those rare people, though, is he not?
Yeah.
I always wish I had that. People who are obsessed with being
he's
fit.
Driven, he's driven, isn't he?
Yeah.
And he wants to be the best he can be. And you know he's got tremendous potential. And things will get tougher for him because the more victories he has, his next fight on May the 11th, he's going to be a six-round fight. It's going to be his sixth fight. Then, if he wins that, the opposition is going to be tougher. It's going to be more difficult. It's going to be a higher level. And there's certainly no question that he'll manage it in terms of his fitness. But what we've always got to remember, he's only 19. He and his dad, Tom, have discussed it with me. And I said, I reckon Gregor will probably, and Tom agrees, probably end up as a welterweight, 10 stone seven. So it's a stone heavier than he is now. He'll mature. And when he becomes a kind of a man, if you like, rather than a youth, which he is now, then we'll see the best of him. Meanwhile, he's gaining experience.
Yeah, I like that he's turned pro at a young age, because if you are in it to make a living as a boxer, well, why waste your time, And
yeah, except you won't make a living as a boxer.
Well, I mean, it's going to be difficult unless you get to the top.
Yeah, that's when you and that's something I like about. Well, Gregor's lucky in as much as he's got the gym. That's his business with his dad, so he's got that as a background, right? But he's driven. He's got, and not that you would ever know. Gregor is the type of guy, and I like this about him, he's modest. He's got humility. There is not a trace of arrogance about him. And that's how I think boxers should be.
You've met a number of boxers of note. Sugar Ray Robinson being one of them, and Walter McGowan,
yeah.
Ken Buchanan. When you look at Gregor, do you see the traits that you saw in some of those guys?
Well, it's hard to say at this stage. The traits, if you're talking about his manner, his demeanour, he's certainly like that. McGowan was a guy I was close to, and he did not have a trace of arrogance, but he had a confidence that you could recognise. Right, when he walked into a room, he was confident. When he went to a restaurant, we went out, he was confident. He was a guy, he never drank, right? And he finished boxing, opened a pub, and drank.
Just drank.
Yeah, and ended up in a psychiatric hospital and died.
Is this because when he was boxing, it was a Spartan life?
Yeah.
And the opportunity to just release from that,
I think that's,
was too strong.
There's a lot in that point, because I think a lot of guys sacrifice a lot to be the very best they can, to be the top of the tree. And then when it's finished, they can't sustain that and think, well, why would I sustain it? Well, I've never drunk. Let's go and have a drink. And then it becomes their obsession. For lots of guys.
I read that Sugar Ray Robinson was a diabetic when he died. You met him, but did he turn to just like eating everything he wanted, bad diet, that kind of thing at the end of his career?
Or? No, I don't know what happened. No, he couldn't have, because he was still boxing when he was in his 40s. Right. When I met him, I trained with him. He was 43 and he came to Scotland to box a guy called Mick Leahy, who was a British middleweight champion in Glasgow, in Paisley Ice Rink, 5,000 people. That was another venue that was, 5,000.
Sugar Ray Robinson boxed in Glasgow. I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah.
Why?
Well, what happened was at that stage of his career, he had so much debt, particularly to the Inland Revenue in America. He came to Europe, and he was in Europe for about 9 months, and he had, in 9 months, I'm trying to remember, but he certainly had about 12 or 13 fights, right? Maybe more, because he was trying to get money to pay the tax man. He came boxing Paisley Ice Rink. I was working with McGowan at that time. McGowan was on that bill, and they said to me, I was down one weekend, they said, right, I'll see you next weekend, but don't come to the gym, come to St. Cuthbert's Church Hall in Hamilton, where McGowan was from. And I said, why? And they said, no, never mind why, just come, So I went down there, and went into the church hall. There was a full-size ring in the hall. There was punch bags, speed balls, everything had been rigged out. All right. And then it hit me. Well, I'll tell you when it hit me, when the door opened to the changing room and I was put on my, they call them wraps nowadays, right? We'd call them bandages, right? I'd put my wraps on, my bandages on, and I turned when the door opened, it was Sugar Ray Robinson. And he was coming to train. That was on the Sunday and the fight was on the Thursday at Paisley Ashrick.
Which church hall was this?
St. Cuthbert's.
Is it still there to this day?
I've no idea. Actually, somebody told me recently it's not.
Okay.
Somebody, when I was telling this story, they said, oh, that's gone now. And so we trained. And then there was only about maybe four of us, as well as Sugar Ray Robinson and his sparring partner, who were invited to train. So can you imagine that? I'm 18. The greatest fighter of all time, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many pundits.
I want to ask you about that, but carry on.
Yeah. He's boxing next to me. He's putting his arm around me in the changing room. He's saying, hi, what's your name? How old are you? And how long have you been boxing? And all that. And I'm in gaga. But the thing about him, so he was 43 at that time. And that was not very long before he retired. I don't know what happened between then and his death in terms of his diabetes and
He did live till he was nearly 70, I think.
Yeah,
But then he
had dementia.
Right.
Right. Okay. So he, and you were thinking, why wouldn't he? When you think of the fights he had, you know, and they were brutal.
A couple of 250 fights or so, something like that, wasn't it? Or was it that many?
Less than that. But the fights he had were never easy. And remember, he was the welterweight champion, middleweight champion, and then would have won the light heavyweight title, but it was the hottest night on record in New York when he fought Joey Maxim for the light heavyweight title. He was miles ahead, but he had to retire on his stool at the end of the 13th. He just couldn't get off his stool.
So the thing I can't get my head round is that it was 15 rounds.
Yeah,
you know, that men fought, because when you look at pro boxing now,
yeah,
they talk about the championship rounds.
Yes,
that's right. From 9 to 12.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what it was like after the championship rounds to do another three.
Yeah.
Those men were hard men.
And in fact, my first coach when I was a kid in Lockie Boxing Club that my dad ran, the coach there was a guy called Frankie Parks. He lived in the same street as me up the top of the road. And he with the last man in Scotland to fight 20 rounds.
20 rounds?
Yeah, yeah. But I'll tell you a better story than that. Oh, this is Jack Johnson, who was one of the great heavyweights of all time. Mm-hmm. Jack Johnson fought Jess Willard for the world title in Havana, Cuba. Willard was the challenger. Johnson was the first black heavyweight champion and was reviled by the white elite, if you like. A, because he was black. B, because he was going with white women. And in those days, 1920s, it was, oh, how dare he kind of thing, you know. And he was an extravagant character, and he was kind of in their face, if you like, of the white establishment. And so they hated him, and they always looked for a great white hope to come along and take the title. So they got this guy called Jess Willard, who was 6'7". He was Texan. He was a farmer. Couldn't fight. Didn't start boxing until he was 27. So they boxed in Havana. And the famous thing was, it was a 45-round contest, and Willard knocked him out in the 26th round. And the famous picture is of Johnson lying on the canvas with his covering his eyes from the sun. He said later on that he did that. He took a dive because of death threats. And Willard made an interesting point. Willard said, well, if there were death threats, why didn't you just chuck it in the second or third round? Why wait to the 22nd round of a 45-round contest?
How long were the rounds? 3 minutes? At that time,
3 minutes, 45. Yeah. But before that, remember, there were rounds and fights. There was one fight which went roughly 8 hours, right? And there were no limits. The round ended when one of the boxers went to the deck, right? And that stopped the round, and then they had the rest and they start again. But these were crazy times. And, you know, you can't imagine the brutality in those days. No. But you can imagine.
No gum shields. No gum shield. Probably nothing. The stuffing on the glove was probably right at the back of the glove.
Horse hair on the gloves. When I started boxing, the gloves were horsehair in the gym. And so the knuckle part was nothing there. The horsehair was either pushed up the hand or down, or both, down the hand. The knuckle part was bare, just leather.
I've got to say, actually, I mean, it wasn't on that level, but my first fight I had, because I was a 91 kilo boxer.
Right.
I was in the Whitfield Labour Club.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, in Dundee.
Yeah.
And
you got a life. Yeah,
I was the runner-up, Frank. So, but when you're 91 kilos, as you know, you box later in the show.
Yes.
So the glove was just so mashed up by the time I got it.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it. It was like, is that what we're wearing, you know?
Yeah, nowadays, so in the pros, they get new gloves every fight.
Every fight, yeah.
But of course, you had to wait for the guy coming out the ring, and then you would get his gloves while another contest was going on.
Aye.
Yeah.
With blood all over it.
Yeah.
That fills you with dread.
Why did we do it?
Actually, I think that's one of the worst things of being a heavier fighter, because you see guys coming back into the changing room with their face mashed up.
Yeah.
There's blood everywhere.
I know.
Someone's been knocked out, and you see them coming in, and you think, oh man.
I know. I'll tell you a story about a heavyweight, and it was again in Bulgaria. Scotland could never find a decent heavyweight, right? We had all the great flyweights, bantamweights, featherweights, like, beyond that, it was getting tougher and tougher. Heavyweights, we couldn't find a decent heavyweight. But through the ABA Championships one year came this guy through the Imperial Services, that's what they call them, the military. And he got to the semi-final of the ABA Championships by way of the Imperial Services. And he was Scottish. And he was in the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders. And his name was Bruce Robertson. And Scotland said, oh, we've discovered a heavyweight now. We didn't know about this guy because he was stationed somewhere in England and they'd never heard of him. So we're going to Bulgaria and the bold Bruce is the heavyweight. And we go over there. And in the first fight in the capital, Sofia, he's up against this guy who's built like an Adonis, you know, a proper athletic heavyweight, big muscles on top of his muscles. And the guy was bang, down. Bruce would go up, bang, down again. He was up and down like a yo-yo, right? So come the second round when he was down. So every time he went down, Bobby Hume, a man called Bobby Hume, was the Scottish referee who was refereeing that contest. And he knew he was in trouble. And he would give him slow counts every time. So he'd say, 6, come on now, Bruce, you're doing well. Up you get now. 7, that's fine. That's, keep going. Now you'll be fine. 8, up, and then Bruce would get up, right?
Doing him a real favour there.
Yeah, through this encouragement until the last time. And Bruce goes down. And Bobby Hume goes through the same drill. That's fine, Bruce. You'll be okay. And there's only a minute left. Up, you get 8. Now, come on now, Bruce. Up on one knee. Make a go. 9. Bruce, it's time you got up now. Bruce looks up at him from the floor and says, you want to fight him? He said, you fight him. 10 out. So he was counted out. Yeah.
I mentioned my first fight there. I had 3 visits to the canvas in my first fight. And the referee was Davy Strachan, who was from Arbroath.
Right.
Whom
I met recently.
Yeah, yeah. And on the third visit to the canvas, because I'm stubborn, right? I'll just get up.
Yeah.
And Davy's standing over me and he started counting. He said, don't get up, don't get up. You know, because he could see I was taking a beating.
Yeah.
I was so unprepared. Frank, I was going into that ring absolutely sure that I was going to be the next Mike Tyson.
Really? I came out like Kathy Tyson.
I've been put through a mangle. Like, because you just have no idea how hard a boxing ring is.
Yeah.
It is incredibly tough. And what you imagine, you think, oh, I'm going to be the next star. No, no.
Yeah.
What a leveler the boxing ring is.
Oh, it is. It's the loneliest place in the world, of course. You're on your own. I say that to kids, you know, the guy in your corner can tell you everything. I never remember anything I was ever told in the corner. The only thing I remember is my dad chatting. He was never in the corner. He was an official. He was a judge, a referee. He ran the Midlands District Boxing. He would just sit and chat to me, and he talked about what you should do, what you've got, this is how you should do it. And it's just the kind of stuff I'm doing now, except I'm actually coaching it. He just used to sit and chat to me. And it was, boxing was never, you know, we were never obsessed, but we never saw it as obsessed. I had so many other interests. I mean, I went away at 19, came back, no, before I went to the European Championships in East Berlin in 1965, I joined a band and became a singer.
Did you? What kind of band?
Pop band. Did all the Beatles covers and things like that. Yeah. And we were had a residency at Perth City Hall every Friday night. And we did other places, Fife and all that stuff. And that was a release for me. And I thought, this is great fun. You know, I'm enjoying this. Gets me out, away from the gym, different things. So I think that's important. But nowadays, you know, it's hard for kids. I try to get over the point. When I say kids, I'm talking about young men and women, I guess. But it's kind of hard. I find that lots of them, most of them, find it hard to think for themselves. Right? And I try to explain to them, at any given point, things will change. You only have a second to react. And you've got to make that split decision and hope that you get it right. Do I throw this punch or will I get caught? Do I block this punch and go that? Do I slip that punch or will I get a thump in the ear if I go that way or go that way? So all these things are going on in your mind. The name of the game or the aim of the game is to hit without being hit back. It's never going to happen. You're always going to take one or two, and that's the real test, right? If you take a bad punch, what do you do? Well, one thing you don't do is you never show you're hurt, because that's the red rag to a bull. So you pretend, you bluff, and you get away with it if you're good.
I was talking to Corey McCulloch about this as well, and I actually think it's the downfall of a lot of fighters after boxing, that because they're so conditioned to not showing that any pain, and it's emotional and physical. They'll hide it. You know, and you have people. I heard Alex Arthur talking about it after his career. He said, you know, you can't complain. No. You can't say anything. You have to hide it. And like you say, when you're fighting, if you let the guy you're fighting see any weakness at all, he's gonna jump on it.
Yeah, you're right. And also tiredness. You know, if you show you're tired, then that's a bad sign. The signal you're sending out to your opponent, say, look, I'm exhausted.
That's such a boost for your opponent. You know when you watch amateurs, especially at novice level, you do often see somebody run out of steam.
Yeah.
What a horrible place that is.
Yeah.
When you've got no energy left.
Yeah.
And there's a round to go. You know, you're
And of course the amateurs different from the pros, because they've only got three rounds, pros have got longer. So the amateurs tend to cover a lot of ground.
Dancing. Very fast.
Yeah, they're all over the place, you know. They'll punch and then they'll run for half a mile, then come back and punch again. And I'm trying to tell them there are ways to conserve your energy. And one of the ways is not to, you know, be, you know, you could be out of distance just by swaying back 2 inches. You don't have to jump back 3 feet to stay out the way.
Aye.
But that's all experience, you know. But you're right, it's a big deal for a young guy to get into the ring. It's you're apprehensive, you're nervous, you're scared. I don't care what anybody says. You're scared. And you got all this bravado, even with the pros, it's all bravado and it's all in your face and the pre-fight press conference nonsense that you see nowadays, you know, they're all kind of nose to nose. What's that about? Why can't we? And the other thing that gets me is they get trumpeted into the ring. You know, they're standing kind of 300 yards away in a doorway with a fake curtain there. Yeah. And I'm thinking, why don't you just walk into the ring and get it on with it?
Well, I mean, that presents another problem for a fighter because you can't warm up, you know, because you warm up, then you got half an hour of national anthems, you've got the ring walk, standing about.
Yeah.
I don't know how they deal. I mean, I admire them for doing that because if they were warming up in the change rooms, they're cold by the time that fight starts.
Yeah, but you're right. But the other thing is psychologically, what does that do to you? You're built up for this fight big style and you're going in there. And I timed it one night in one of the big fights and it took 10 minutes to make the announcements. Well, for them to get into the ring and then make the announcements. And then they read out the guy's history. They read out his inside leg measurement, where his wife works, all that stuff. And I'm thinking, just get on with it. We all know who he is. We all know that he's this champion, he's won these fights, he's lost two or whatever. Just say his name and
it's
go on.
It's become more convoluted as time's gone on, hasn't it?
It's showbiz now, you know. It's not so much, it's kind of showbiz stroke sport. It's like that guy Ben Whittaker. Have you seen him in action? He's like that YouTube stuff from Jerry Lewis that film, you know. And you think, hang on, just box.
I mean, all the press conferences and everything, if they just got on with it.
Yeah.
So let's just get straight to it, lads, and let's find out who's going to win. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of draw. I mean, I sometimes go down the rabbit hole of watching Travelers bare-knuckle boxing, and it's just straight to the point, isn't it? You know, just have a fight.
Listen, I've had an inquiry from a traveller in England who wants me to teach him how to box because he's got a big fight coming off, bare-knuckle.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and he does it anyway. He's a bare knuckle fighter, but he watches my videos, and he got in touch just yesterday and said, "I'm going to come up." He's from Kent. "I'm going to come up. Can you give me 2 hours of your time?" And I said, "You do realise that I'm in Aberdeen. I don't care. I'll come up and we'll do it, and I'll fly back again because I got a fight coming up." I watch these bare-knuckle guys and I think, oh my goodness, why would you do that? The even thought of punching with a bare-knuckle, you know, with your hand, I think, I couldn't handle that. I get questions all the time. Do you ever spar? Do you still spar? And I'm thinking, hang on a second, I'm 78. Maybe I could do three two-minute rounds. I would love to spar. Okay, I would have the head guard, I'd have the sparring gloves on and so on. I would love to spar. But I keep joking, you know, that somebody probably call Help the Aged or one of these agencies to say, do you realise you better get this guy out of here, you know? And then what would happen, it would be very awkward for my sparring partner. He would think, well, I better not touch him, you know, in case I'll get a trouble for hitting an old guy.
Well, you know something, Frank, with the way things are going in the world and your social media account, I think Jake Paul's going to be offering you a contract.
Says that. Yeah, fight Jake Paul. Yeah,
I'd root for you. I think you would beat Jake Paul.
Except he's 28 and I'm 78, so there's a bit of a difference.
he's always looking for a weaker opponent in some way, you know. Everybody he fights has got like some kind of disadvantage, you know. So
But I
think you'd probably still beat him because you know something. It's not, you'll know this, right? And it's just the same with Mike Tyson, right? When doesn't matter how old you get, you know how to land a punch.
Yeah,
it's the timing.
Yeah,
it's the actual timing and the distance and where you put your feet and and all of that. I know Jake Paul's got probably quite good training and everything now, but it takes time to get that embedded in you. And when it's in there, it's always there.
You're right. It takes time. You've got to grow up with it. You can't just turn to age of 26 and 27 and say, right, I'm going to be a boxer now. Now, to give him his due, he looks like a boxer. He trains like a boxer. He's incredibly fit. You got to hand it to him. He devotes the time, but he hasn't got the inbuilt experience or expertise. He hasn't grown up in the world of boxing. He's had 10 contests, one of which was a proper contest. The others are spars, exhibitions.
Even that contest, I think Tommy Fury carried him.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't see Tommy Fury. If he really started to unload his shots the way he wanted to, I think he would have just
crushed him. Same with Mayweather and Conor McGregor.
Oh, I know. You know, that's a lot of nonsense.
That's a nonsense. And let's carry him for a few rounds and then just get it
over. A lot of people believed that McGregor was in that fight, which frustrates me, because you think Mayweather fought a who's who of the best fighters of the last 25 years.
Yeah.
Ricky Hatton, Saul Alvarez, you know, people like that. They couldn't lay a glove on him.
No.
And then all of a sudden he walks out in front of Logan Paul.
Yeah.
No, Conor McGregor.
Yeah.
And he's just got his hands up taking shots. He's doing that out of choice.
Yeah.
It's not because Conor McGregor's beating him up, you know.
I know. It's a crazy world.
It's nonsense.
It's just, you know, I'm just worried that we're going to see more and more of this. But if Jake Paul is suitably dispatched by Mike Tyson, I hope that brings a curtain down on this nonsense. Really do.
I think it will. I mean, it depends what's in the contract, isn't it? You know, is Mike, are we going to see Mike Tyson, you know? Did you watch his fight that he had with, it was an exhibition that he had with Roy Jones?
No, I didn't. Well, I watched bits of it.
So I watched that, and Roy Jones was really struggling.
Well, Roy, yeah, he was.
Jones when he, you know, not long finished fighting. He was fit. But he couldn't handle Mike Tyson.
No, he couldn't. And how could you handle a guy? Somebody once asked me, I helped on a documentary about Ken Buchanan, and we spoke about Roberto Duran. How would you fight Roberto Duran? I said, with a claw hammer in each hand, and you would still get beat. Because you can't stop these guys. You know, a bazooka, you might stop him. But, you know, these guys are just, can you imagine Tyson coming at you and punching every half second?
He gets in so fast as well.
Yeah.
He's so quick to close that distance.
And you don't know where he's going to hit you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think Duran and Tyson were very similar. Like, because Duran, he got in tight and he threw those body shots.
Well, he had to
head and body.
You know, ended up as a middleweight, 5'7". So he's going to have to get close, you know. But you look at Duran, all these guys, as they get older, they're slowing up and the speech is slurred. And they're not as kind of quick as they were. And you think, well, you know, that's been a hard life you've had, taking a hell of a lot of punches.
Roberto Duran gave us some incredible moments. And that Fantastic Four with Leonard Hearns.
Oh, my goodness.
Duran.
Yeah.
Marvin Hagler.
Hagler, yeah. I mean that was a golden era for the middleweights. Even Hearns. I mean, wow. When that second round knockout over Duran, when he stepped just in with the right
dropped
cross,
him like a tree.
Oh, my goodness.
Aye.
Yeah. But why? These are special fighters. I mean, that's what I was saying earlier on. These are at the top of the tree. You cannot get any better than them.
And they were doing 15 rounds, I believe. I think it was 15 at that
rounds.
Time. When you look back at Sugar Ray Leonard at that time, And he had great fights with Duran.
Yep.
The intensity of those guys.
Yeah. And as you say, 15 rounds. And not only that, there you are. How did they conduct themselves? They conducted themselves like proper champions, with a good attitude, a humility, a respect for their fellow man, for their opponent, and a discipline to their life. That's what makes a champion, right? They don't go shouting, I'm going to knock you out in 5 rounds, or I'm going to beat you to a pulp. They don't go kind of behaving like thugs, which is what you see now. You know, you get the fight during the pre-fight press conference. You get guys acting stupidly. I mean, you get Tyson Fury bringing his dad along, and he's just a disruptive creature. Why would you have him in the room? Get him out, you know. And you get people say to me, but that's part of selling. I don't believe that. I don't believe you need that to sell a fight, a big fight. You do not need it. It's a distraction, and it's demeaning to the sport of boxing. It brings boxing into disrepute, in my view.
The best fight I've ever been to, Frank, needed none of that. It was Calzaghe versus Kessler.
Yeah.
I went down to the Millennium Stadium for that. It was a sellout.
Yep.
You saw the highest standard of boxing. Nothing but respect between the two fighters. It was totally unnecessary to have any. You didn't. Boxing fans want to see that.
What is it? What does it add to the fight? Nothing. It adds nothing to the fight. This is all about the promotion, and it's all about the pay-per-view on TV. They think, the guys who produce these programs think that's what the boxing fans want. Do they? I don't know. Unless boxing fans have changed over the generations, which they probably have. But when I was boxing, and the great era of the boxers in the 50s and 60s and 70s, people went to boxing because they were knowledgeable, they were interested, they were invested in boxing, and they knew all about the boxers who were on the bill, amateur or professional. Paid their money at the door, there was no booze involved, they went home happy, and you know, and the next day in the pub they would discuss the fights and what went wrong and what happened and all that stuff. Nowadays, I go to amateur shows, and of course nowadays they're all dinner shows, right? You get a supper or a dinner, and you get as much booze as you can. So what you do as the night wears on and the boxing wears on, you've got a lot of young guys, especially, who've been drinking on empty heads. And then by the end of the night, they're bloated and they're out of control and they're noisy and they're disruptive and they're standing, blocking the views. You know, I sound like an old fogey, which I am.
You're a boxing purist, Frank.
Yeah, I want to go and sit there and watch the boxer. Mm-hmm. It was like I remember going to see, I can't remember who it was. It might have been Bob Dylan when he came to the exhibition centre.
Not boxing, I hope. he was singing on this occasion.
Yes. And I went, and I thought, these big concerts, I'd never really experienced them before. Next thing is, you know, he's 2 minutes into his first song and everybody's on their feet. And I'm sitting and I'm thinking, I can't see a thing here. I've just paid whatever I paid for it. I have to get up and have to stand up and see this. And it's like that with boxing. You know, you get this, everybody's standing. Why aren't you sitting? Well, it's, you know, you've paid for a seat. Why not? But listen, that's just me. I'm a purist. Aye. That's what I want to see.
Frank, we were talking about the Fantastic Four there, that era in the 80s. And I said about Sugar Ray Robinson. Yeah. I want to ask you, I'm going to ask you to be Bert Sugar here, right? And give me your top three fighters of all time. And why are they the top three fighters?
Well, that's a hard one. You know what? Sugar Ray Robinson, for me, was the greatest.
Number one.
Because he had all the attributes. He had, in the era you're talking about, the four great middleweights, Hearns, Hagler, Duran, and Leonard, it's hard for me to argue that they weren't as good as Sugar Ray Robinson. But Sugar Ray Robinson, for me, was just a pure, beautiful athlete who could fight and box and do the tricks. And, you know, he won the middleweight championship 5 times. He was the welterweight champion. He boxed in an era where it was brutal, it was difficult, and he just came out at the top of the heap, you know. So for me, he was the best. Where do we go from there? I think one of your four, Hearns, Hagler, Leonard, Hearns,
Duran.
I think, you know, Sugar Ray Leonard is up there. I don't know if I'd put him. I think the second one I'd put with Joe Louis, the heavyweight champion. Now, what you've got to remember is that in those days, the heavyweights were 13, 13 and a half stone. Nowadays, they're beasts like 20 stone Tyson Fury. You can't talk like for like over that. You just talk about ability. As a heavyweight champion, as a champion, he was a beautiful boxer and probably the best one-punch knockout man of all time. Right. When he hit them with his left hook or his right cross, That was it, finished. He was a terrific fighter.
He was Sugar Ray Robinson's next door neighbour. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
I found that out recently, yeah.
I didn't know
they were neighbours. When Robinson was a boy,
yeah,
he grew up next to Joe
knew
Lewis.
I knew that Lewis was his hero, but I didn't know that they were neighbours.
Neighbours. Yeah. What's the chances?
Yeah. But I would put him there. Why are we always talking about the heavier guys, I suppose? I mean, you've got guys, and I'm only going from what I've read about them. You've got guys like Jimmy Wild, the flyweight champion of the world from
Welsh, wasn't he?
He was Welsh. Yeah. You've got guys like him. You've got Willie Pep, the great featherweight champion, the best left hand in the business. You've got all these guys. It's difficult. But then one guy that many people overlook is Rocky Marciano.
He was my favourite. I loved Rocky Marciano.
Well, I hold him up as an example of how to throw the cross, right? I see lots of boxers nowadays, professional, when they're training, not so much in fights, but throwing a straight arm cross. And I throw my hands up in horror because that's not the way. So I teach the cross the way it should be, which is stepping in and the punch travels 6 inches. And it's so devastating, it kind of... It does real damage. Rocky Marciano, if you look at his fight when he won the world championship against Jersey Joe Walcott, and he stepped in with a short right cross, which if you blinked, you would have missed it.
A slightly bent arm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, much bent. It is a bent arm. And he did that all the time. Marciano, 5'10.5", short guy, 5'10", for his weight as a heavyweight, 13.5 stone, 49 fights, 49 victories.
Incredible.
So you have to put him up there. I mean, he was a bruiser, couldn't box to save himself. But he knew his strengths and he used them to the full advantage. So you got to put him up there. What are we talking about? The top three or the top five?
Well, give me the top five.
Well, I can't think now. You know,
about Muhammad Ali? Would you put him in your list?
I think you have to, but you know, I wasn't the biggest fan of Ali. I mean, Ali changed the dial on boxing because he was the one who really started this, I'm going to knock you out in five and all the poetry and all that, which he stole from wrestling, right? That's the way the wrestlers behaved and they did it because they weren't a sport, they were show business. But he thought, that's the way I'm going to sell tickets. In the early days, I thought he did it out of fear half the time. When he fought Liston, I thought he was terrified. I think he got a shock when Liston, you know, retired on his stool. And then he began to realise, well, actually, I'm good. I'm fast for a heavyweight. I've got great hands, I've got great feet. I would have liked to have seen him against, well, we saw what happened when he got older and guys like Larry Holmes and Ken Norton came into it, you know, and poor Ali by then, he lost 3 years through his problems with refusing to
the draft. You know that fight he had with Frazier, the Thrill in Manila?
Yeah.
That's the only fight I could say I've ever watched that was actually a hard watch.
Yeah.
And hard watching that it was just so brutal.
Yeah.
It was so brutal. The heat, the intensity that they fought one another, you know.
I know.
It almost went beyond boxing when you were watching. I was like, I mean, those guys are killing each other.
Yes. And also, you've got to pay tribute to Ali because he showed that as well as being a beautiful boxer, he could fight. And more importantly, he could take a punch. He could take lots of punches. But then, you know, it saddened for him as he got older. He went on too long. He started taking beatings and he ended up with Parkinson's and his problems, his medical problems. But in his day, fantastic. But, you know, lots of things you could look at with Ali and say there was touches of the novice about him. You know, when he was hit, you saw that in the George Foreman fight, the head went up when he was against the ropes, and you put your head up, which is what you don't do. You put your chin up in the air to be hit. When in fact, you should put your chin, you tuck your chin in, get your head down to avoid the punches. But the Foreman fight was an interesting one for me because I have a theory about that. Post-fight, Ali said he had adopted this tactic of allowing Foreman to punch himself out. He called it rope-a-dope, remember?
Mm-hmm.
I think that was all right with the benefit of hindsight. But if you look at the fight, I thought, well, he did punch himself out, Foreman, but I don't think it was a tactic that Ali adopted because he took so many punches that, you know, the courage took him through. Not Foreman's lack of fitness or kind of blowing up. Ali's thing about, you know, being courageous was absolutely true, but it wasn't a tactic. I don't think he had any option because Foreman battered the hell out of him for all those rounds before he ran out of steam. And then look how quickly it turned. 10 seconds, bang, 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 bang. It was all over. Foreman was all over the place. He was exhausted and he was finished. And hand it to Ali. So where does he sit? He's got to sit number four, say. Number five, I don't know. You have to look at the lighter weights. There were some brilliant fighters. I mean, I mentioned Willie Pep, you know, some of the great Archie Moore, the light heavyweight champion. Wonderful fighters.
Ancient Archie.
Yeah. Harry Greb, if you go back to Harry Greb.
I've read
Greb.
About Harry Greb. I've never seen him fight, but I did read he had an incredible story.
Oh, amazing. Stanley Ketchell. All these guys.
Where does a modern fighter now, though, like Floyd Mayweather, fit in with these guys?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because when you were talking about Mayweather earlier, I was going to interject and say Mayweather would certainly have a claim to be among the greatest of all time. And for me, he is up there. So let's replace him with Ali with him. And the reason I'm saying that is because Mayweather had this incredible ability to win fights with sheer skill and tactics and brain power. I always think you've got to outthink your opponent rather than outfight him. If you can outfight as well, that's a bonus. But if you're outthinking your opponent, even although he's the hardest man in the world, you are special. Mayweather was special. And I thought that, you know, how he defended himself, how he eased himself through contests, he never took chances, he was not a risk taker, he was special, very, very special.
You know what we were saying earlier about your face not being mashed up? Look at his face at the end of his career.
I know.
You know, not a mark on him.
Not a mark. And you're right. And the thing about him is, of course, it's a fact. Las Vegas's economy for a long time depended on Mayweather because of his fights in Las Vegas and because he brought so many people to Vegas to see his fights. And they would spend days there and they would gamble and they would spend shops and restaurants and bars. And I remember reading something about that when he retired, the Las Vegas local authority, if you like, they were saying, our economy is going to suffer because he brought hundreds of millions of dollars into Vegas during his career because all his fights were there, virtually. Yeah.
This is what I don't get because he could have filled a bigger stadium. You know, because those arenas in Vegas are not that big.
No.
He could have filled the Dallas stadium easily.
Well,
Floyd.
Look at the Tyson fight that's come out against Jake Paul. 80,000 going to be in Austin and Texas. 80,000.
How's there 80,000 people that want to buy a ticket to that?
And we don't even know how many rounds are going to box.
Oh, I want to ask you about health and well-being.
Yeah.
For people of your age, right, what would you say to them about, you know, your health, your fitness and staying active? Because you're very active. I've seen you hitting the bag. You're hitting hard.
Yeah, lots of people ask me that, you know, and I could give you a glib reply. But the only thing I could say is I've never abused myself. I like a glass of wine two or three times a week with dinner. I don't go to pubs. I don't drink beer. I don't drink fizzy drinks. I don't snack. I don't eat crisps, anything like that, right? So that's helpful. I'm not saying I am a food guru. I'm not saying I am a nutritionist or I know how that you should look after yourself. I'm only telling you how it affects me. My wife, Sharon, cooks fresh every single day.
Lucky you.
Every single day. Nice. I am lucky. And I say that, and she cooks fresh every single day. But more and more, what we're finding, and it's just evolution for me, is I would say that probably 80%, 90% maybe, of the meals I eat in a week are vegetarian. And it's not because we've decided to become vegetarians. We haven't. I still have chicken or the occasional steak. I'm not a big fan of red meat. And I'm going out with journalist colleagues tomorrow night for dinner, and I'll have meat there probably. I have lots of pasta. I have eggs. I have... in the morning, right, I get up, and my wife has the cup, the mug in front of me and says, there, you take that. And it's warm water with half a lemon squeezed in it. And I have that. And that's my rehydration first thing in the morning. Then after my shower, I have breakfast, which is a cup of tea and toast with apricot jam and a banana. And that's it until maybe late lunch, early afternoon, I'll have a fruit salad and yogurt. And then I have a main course meal about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and I don't eat again till breakfast the next day.
That's pretty healthy, Frank. Very healthy.
It is healthy. Yeah. But I mean, it's not designed.
No, it's just...
I haven't gone out to say, right, this is a regime we're going to stick to. This is just the way we live.
It's the food you enjoy.
Yeah. So it fits me, and it works for me. And people have said that to me on, you know, in the comments on Instagram and TikTok. Wow, how do you keep so healthy? And I don't know. I just do this.
What I want to know, though, Frank, is what motivates you to exercise at your age?
Yeah, I don't know. And people say, why? You're punching the bag full tilt. You're going at full power when you're punching the bag. And honestly, quite honestly, Michael, I say, it's the only way I know how. Right? I like the gym. I like skipping. I like shadow boxing. I like punching the bag. I don't do it as often as I used to. I was doing 3 days a week, and I was doing an hour session every day, full out, straight through. I do lots of floor exercises, you know, tummy stuff and all that, but nothing special. I'm not kind of some guy that's going, oh, look at this guy. I'm lucky. I don't put on weight, really. In fact, I've dropped weight in the last year. It's just my diet is good, everything in moderation, cut out the fizzy drinks, no snacks, nothing like that. And I just, that's me.
Do you feel aches and pains when you train?
No. That's another question I get asked all the time. I get guys saying, oh, you know what, Michael, I must tell you this. I get so many comments from guys who are in their 50s and 60s, even their 40s. I got one, I'll tell you about in a minute, one from Bulgaria I got the other day. But guys in their 50s and 60s said to me, I watch your videos and you have inspired me either to go back to the gym, because that's what I used to be. I used to box as an amateur, or I used to go to the gym and train and never really compete. You've inspired me to go back to that. Or this is guys in their 50s and 60s, or others who have said, I've never boxed in my life, I've never trained, but you've inspired me to go.
That's very rewarding to hear things like that.
Yeah, that's for me. Mm-hmm. Listen, that's all I would ever want from it. I've said to guys, go along to your local boxing gym, say, can I come and train? If somebody says to you, no, you're not allowed, you can't train, let me know. And I'll get on to them, because boxing is a community, right? And guys who not so many, more the young guys than the older guys who go along to the gym are maybe a bit apprehensive. Well, how, you know, how do? I want to, don't be shy. Go in, go up the coach or whoever and say, can I come and train here? Now, I've been to gyms round about Scotland doing my seminars, and I've seen a couple of older guys in their 60s, right? And they're just working alongside. Now, I guess that when they would go the first time, they'd think, well, how are they? They're going to look at me as if some the old codger. What is he doing here? You know, white-haired guy or bald with a pot belly. What is he doing here? Don't think that. Go in there, join in. Nobody will pay any blind bit of attention to you. Just go and work out. Get the endorphins going in the brain. You'll come out there, you'll feel like a champion.
You know, that's one thing I love about boxing clubs is they're the least judgmental places going, you know, because in say a football team, you have, 11 players.
Yeah.
Nobody wants one player that's letting the team down.
No.
Right? But in a boxing club, it's a room full of individuals and nobody cares.
No.
They're only interested in themselves.
Yeah.
You know? And yeah.
And that's a great thing about boxing. You're on your own.
Yeah.
You know, in a contest, in a fight, you're on your own. And I say, guys, the coach would be telling you, by the way, in between rounds, by the way, look out for his jab or look, you know, or he's doing this, he's making this mistake, or you're making this mistake, that you can go in out when the bell rings and it could all change because that guy could change his tactics. So you have to adapt. So you're on your own. You have got to think for yourself and do it for yourself. And that's the difference between boxing and a team game. It's the difference between tennis and a team game. You're on your own. You've got to make your own tactics. As for the nutrition, the diet, listen, you only get one life. Why make yourself into some kind of walking medical disaster? Why, you know, just think, okay, am I comfortable in my own kind of the way I am, in my shape, in my, yeah, if you are, fine. Don't do anything. If you're not, do something about it.
Okay, Frank, a couple of questions before we wrap up. What advice would you give a young fighter in the sport of boxing right now? If you could just give them like a couple of nuggets of information that you wish someone had told you, is there anything you could say to a young fighter?
Well, what I would say is, remember, it's the noble art of self-defense, right? It's a skill. It's a technique. Don't go in there because too many fighters go in there thinking, I'm going to knock him out. Knockouts are few and far between in amateur boxing. What you've got to go in there to say, this is the game of violent chess. We're going to try and outwit this guy, and I'm going to try and hit him without being hit back. When he tries to hit me, I'm going to counterpunch. I'm going to make him make mistakes and capitalize on that. So what I say is, don't be going in there like a wild animal, a bull, trying to kill somebody. What you got to be there is a technician when you go into the ring and learn how to box properly with skill and with, you know, with proper technique.
Okay. And last question I love to ask, and to be honest with you, Frank, you've been in my position because you're a journalist, yeah, right? So, but if you were podcasting right now and you could speak to anybody,
yeah,
dead or alive, anybody from history, who would you like to do a podcast with?
Well, I'd love to have done a podcast with Frank Sinatra. I went to see him in 1988, was it 88 or 89 when he came to Ibrox, and he was 76. And I thought, oh, I have to go and see him. Because I just love that guy. You talk about the elite. You talk about the elite, and then above the elite, he was there. I went to see him, and he was every bit as good as I expected or I'd hoped for. I didn't expect. I thought he'll go through the motions. I'm Frank Sinatra. You'll get the show, and people will say, I saw Frank Sinatra. He gave it everything, and I thought he was fantastic. I've read so many books about him. Of course, his relationship with the mafia and all that stuff. He's a guy I would love to. I was lucky because as a TV journalist, I got to interview so many people, you know, in politics, show business. I mean, one of the first kind of celebrity ones was a guy called James Clavell, who wrote the Shogun novels and King Rat and all that. And this guy was just an absolute gentleman. And an American guy, and he just breezed through an interview. I did Charlton Heston, Dame Edna Everage, I've interviewed Tony Blair, lots of politicians, and some of these guys are just wonderful. Most of them, every one of them was wonderful. The only guy that I was disappointed with, and only because he was dull, was a guy called Mark McCormack, who was discovered Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus and built the IMG empire based on them. Now they're a huge agents for all the big sports stars and TV companies he has and all that stuff. But listen, I could go through a list of 100 people, but Frank Sinatra, I would love to have sat down with Sinatra and spoken to him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Frank, it's been an absolute pleasure, and I really appreciate you coming in, sharing your experiences and your knowledge on the show, and hopefully speak to you again sometime soon, and we'll see how everything's developing. And I reckon you're going to have a pro boxer underneath you by that point, or more going on in the social media side as well. So,
well, that's my aim. The social media thing is now my aim. I want to use that to get my message out. The boxers and people who are invested in the sport about what it should be like.
Okay. Well, very important before we go, Frank, where can people find you?
Right. Instagram at Frank's Noble Art. Mm-hmm. TikTok at Gil Feather. And I've got my Noble Art bag mitts, which are going to be so important for boxers who want to punch properly. And you can get them from www.thenobleart.shop.
Perfect. Frank, thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael.